Well, good morning, London. It is. It's a lovely, quiet Monday morning as I walk through central London on my way to record with today's guest. A guest who probably needs no introduction to a lot of you, but Matthew Bitton, a French-born photographer, but he's travelled the world and he's photographed everyone. He's very well known for his photos of Lenny Kravitz. He has just released a book called Paris Blues. Paris Blues is named a little bit after the film from 1961 with Paul Newman and Sidney Poitier, which I watched this weekend in preparation for this conversation, and blimey Charlie, they do not make movie stars like that anymore. Holy smokes. Paul Newman is amazing. Sidney Poitier is brilliant. It's well worth a watch if you can track it down. I had to find it on the internet, but depending on where you are in the world, it might be easier to see. But I'm really excited to talk to Matthew. We met in Wetzlar earlier this year. He signed his copy of Paris Blues for me, and I pored over it last week in preparation for this conversation. So please do sit back and enjoy this chat with Matthew. Well, this is civilized, isn't it?
I know.
Coffee and sugar and biscuits and...
camera.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. And you use the Visiflex all the time.
Well, the main reason is I've been using a lot of non-Leica, weird, like, old lenses converted to M.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So some of them aren't coupled.
Yeah.
And then I find myself with the glasses somehow.
Yeah.
It's a little easier with the Viso, I don't know. But
yeah.
It's one of those things, like, I got used to it. You know, I don't necessarily need it unless I have one of those lenses. But the other day I made the mistake of taking one of those lenses that's, it's rangefinder coupled, but it's from the 40s.
Right.
It was rangefinder coupled in the 70s, so it's off.
Right.
And I was like, fuck, it looked to me, I mean, I was perfectly on the, you know, in the camera, and then all the photos were blurry because of it. So I was like, so I actually got a second Visiflex because I usually have the M11 and the monochrome.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't like to convert color.
No, yeah. No. But I mean, why have the tool and then not,
yeah,
you know, use exactly. It? It's just, there's no point.
Exactly.
Yeah. The mono would be the one thing I might break my one camera rule for.
I mean,
because it's so specific.
Yeah.
And because it can, you know, like, it can shoot in the dark. And I do have, like, I've got two projects kind of on the go at the minute. Like, one is one I want to get off the ground that skies, and that works in color best.
Yeah.
But the other one is behind the scenes. And I just think behind the scenes photography, well, it just creates this, it's one of the things.
You look nervous.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I don't know how to be in photos. Yeah, I'll have to ask your advice on being photographed, because someone took a picture of me yesterday that was one of those rare situations where someone gets a good photo of me.
Right.
And especially if you're behind the camera a lot,
yeah,
people,
yeah,
don't get a lot of photos of you.
Sure.
And so I just don't know how to be. Like, the minute someone holds the camera up, I go, I was looking through the book last week in preparation.
Mm.
And I watched Paris Blues at the weekend because I'd never seen it.
Such a great
movie. Holy shit, what a movie.
Yeah.
It's great. Like, Paul Newman and Sidney Poitier, just, oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, and I read something recently that the book that it's based on was written by Timothy Chalamet's dad.
No way.
Or grandfather.
Right.
Probably would have to be grandfather.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's something I just kind of recently discovered.
It's proper movie star stuff, though.
And it's just so beautifully, you know, beautifully shot, and it's my Paris, you know.
Yes.
It's like my I don't know, when I see that movie, I literally feel like I'm walking around Paris. And
yeah.
And that's why when I was thinking about, okay, I'm, you know, I got a book deal,
yeah,
doing a second book after my Darker Than Blue book, and it's like, what do I want to do? And I've been dealing with my father, who has Alzheimer's, so I've been going to Paris more to spend time with him. And then the nostalgia that this phase of my life with my father having Alzheimer's is causing,
yeah,
feels like, you know, I'm just falling in love with my childhood and Paris all over again, because as he loses memories, I'm remembering memories. You know, it's like I'm almost like telepathically receiving the memories he's losing. And as you're trying to hold on to something, Paris became the therapy for me, you know, just walking around. Oh, I remember when we were here. I remember when he took me here. That's why I go to the flea markets every Sunday when I'm in Paris, because that's what I did with my dad since I was in the stroller. And there's a whole chapter in it. And so I'm sitting around my place with my girlfriend Grace, and I said, yeah, I think I'm going to do a Paris book and show. And she looked at me, she's like, oh, Paris Blues. And I was like, she says, that's, you know, one of your favorite movies. And I was like, normally maybe I wouldn't take, you know, the name of something. But then Darker Than Blue was from the song We People Who Are Darker Than Blue by Curtis Mayfield. So I was like, well, I got a theme going where I'm basically paying tribute to the things that inspired me. It's not like I'm biting or stealing something. I'm borrowing a sort of a piece of something and making it my own, you know, it's the title. And I actually had forgotten, because I actually have a copy from a long time ago of the book Paris Blues that the movie was based on. But for me, it was just really literal Paris Blues, walking around dealing with my father, you know, deteriorating and feeling like, man, I got the blues and this is, you know, but the city inspires me, and having the camera in my hands is me recording, you know, it's a diary of what's being lost, and someday I won't be here anymore. And so it's like a way to pass down to my children, you know, this moment in time. So there. Yeah.
Do you know the Japanese photographer, is his name Shin Yaguchi?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he photographed his father when he was ill. He had cancer and smoked his entire life, and so he
like 3 packs a day.
Right. Yeah, my mom did, and we lost her to that. And it's funny because my grandmother's got Alzheimer's as well, and so we're having similar experiences where the memories are for us now, I think, rather than for them, you know, like the time with them.
Oh, yeah,
she's on a loop that's about 3 to 5 minutes long now, where it's just, that's the same, so you hang out and it's sad, but you get her talking about the past, and like you say, like nostalgia becomes a common thing that you can share in. And, you know, for her, I'm talking to her about my granddad and old motorcycles that he had, you know, cameras was a thing. And
that's cool.
Yeah, it's lovely. But it's evident in the book, I think. It's a very personal book.
Yes.
For you. Very. And it feels as well like the beginning of the book, with the photos of Paris and the streets and the things that you're experiencing, finding there, that felt so raw and so... I was really impressed at like how open you were willing to be, I guess, with those images. Because the latter stuff, the more celebrity stuff, like I mean, Dave in the snow, obviously awesome. Lenny looks great next to a motorcycle. Yeah, you know, you can't take a bad photo of Lenny Kravitz. Yeah. But
or the Eiffel Tower behind you.
Exactly, right? Like, you know, you had all the props. Yeah. But it
illegal shoot, by the way. We just ran up on that.
Wonder.
Yeah. But then the cops came and they saw it was Lenny and they were like, oh, can we get a selfie?
I heard something once from people when they were trying to do stuff in Bond movies. They were phoning up asking for permission to shoot and they said no, and then they said, well, what's it for? And they said Bond, and then suddenly all the obstacles fell away and they could film on the Thames. But when you were making that, was that a conscious, did you know you had the deal, you've decided Paris, were you expecting to be as sort of vulnerable with the beginning?
Well, you know, the vulnerability kind of grew with the project. So I started, you know, knowing I was doing a Paris project, and initially it was like, you know, which photos of which celebrities do I have in Paris? And then, you know, started thinking like, oh damn, I, you know, like Ben Harper is one of my dearest friends and, you know, amazing artist. I photographed him a million times, but somehow never in Paris. And I was like, shit, okay, maybe I'll do a different concept, that I'll do a music book, but I kept being pulled back to Paris. I was like, okay, well, Ben, he's in the first book, he'll be in the next book, whatever. But I started accepting that I couldn't now sort of surgically go in and like, okay, well, hey, are you available? Can we meet in Paris so I can get these photos? The only one I did that with was Lenny, because he's the only one who has a whole chapter in the book dedicated to him, because, you know, spent over a decade on the road with him. And so I was like, man, and his dreads are long again. So he was like, we don't have much like new stuff. Let's go get some new stuff. So we took a day or two and walked around Paris, did some cool motorcycle stuff, did some cafe, Paris cafe, all very organic, you know, so that's the only exception I made of, you know, specifically shooting stuff. And of course, as I was working on it, I had already, after I think last summer, 2024, I came back to the States and was really focusing on editing. And one night, you know, I had thought about, you know, I should write some kind of foreword. And I was basically like sitting on my couch watching, I think I was watching In the Heat of the Night for the 100th time, you know, Sidney Poitier, Rod Steiger. And something about what, you know, that experience of watching something you've seen many times before, but it always feels entertaining. I was like, I should like open up a little bit. I should kind of be, you know, unafraid to just be vulnerable. And so I opened my computer, you know, Microsoft Word or something, and literally did like stream of consciousness, you know, just started writing. And then next thing I know, it's like 7 in the morning, wow. You know, and I'm like, whoa, I've just written a lot, you know, and thinking, and I was getting really emotional because I'm thinking about, you know, I just gotten back and the condition my dad was in, started missing my grandparents. You know, you start thinking as you write, and the memories just kind of kept really flowing, you know. And so that process was probably the best part of making this book, because I love to write and I don't think I'm too bad at it. And I felt like I'm a collector of so many things, you know. So I basically dug up my brain, and like I was thinking about this book by Henry Miller and Brassai, who's one of my, you know, beyond inspiration, one of the greatest photographers. And they had a book called in the 40s called Quiet Days in Clichy. And I was like, oh, I have one of those books. And they're like, you look it up, it's like $2,000 or something to find an original copy. I have a first edition. And so I started going into my book collection, because I have a serious collection of like signed books and you know, Allen Ginsberg and all the people that in high school, when I moved from France to LA, I just kind of became, you know, obsessed with the Jack Kerouacs and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Gregory Corso, the Beat Generation. And then earlier, you know, the Henry Millers and it was also, there's a guy named Stephen Longstreet. I don't know if you're familiar. It was probably put out 110 books, was one of the most prolific writers, but one of my favorite painters, illustrators. So this guy was like just kind of a wild dude, and he had some Paris books. And so I just kind of started like, you know, going to the shelf and looking and reading and you know, I would just be like, oh, Shakespeare and Company, that this reminds me of blah, blah, blah. And then just write about it. And then started going through maybe 30,000 photos, I think, you know, over a period of the next month. And I kind of took a little time off touring and everything, because I knew I had to deliver this thing in time to get copies for the November opening at the Leica store. And so that really became a whole different kind of meditation for me, you know, and what do I include and what do I not include? And, you know, do I put the ex-girlfriends in there? Do I not? Do I do the nudes? Do I not? Do I blah, blah, blah. Is that the place I'm in now? Do I put an artist who, you know, I've shot great photos of, that I was a big fan of, who all of a sudden has a song called Heil Hitler, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. That was before this Heil Hitler song, but you know what I mean? Like, the guy has just gone completely nuts. And then I had to be real with myself and say, well, I captured these moments when I captured them. And so, you know, as much as I absolutely despise Donald Trump, I'm always thinking like, if I had an opportunity to photograph him, of course I would photograph him, you know what I mean? And there's nobody that I can think of where, you know, it doesn't have to be a personal situation. Like, you can photograph a portrait of, you know, a dictator, a Mussolini or whatever, and you get a great photo. It doesn't mean you like the guy, you know? And so I started debating, you know, do I put Kanye West in the book? And then I looked at the picture that I have in the book, and I was like, you know what? It's a great picture. It's a moment in time. You have this French artist, Hollande, that's on the left, and then he's hugging Yassine Bey, Mos Def. It was at Rick Owens' apartment. And I was like, I'm going to be true to myself. Like, this is a thing I like. I don't care. And people have said, I can't, you know, message me, I can't believe you have this in your book. I returned it, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. You know, I respect that, but that's not really how I see things. But so as I got deeper and deeper into it, I just kind of completely let, you know, let the vulnerability flow. And even down to the insecurity of having certain pictures that were like reflections of me in a mirror, where I was like, oh, that's such a, you know, is that an egomaniacal thing, or is that just a great picture and it's part of me? And then, you know, much like when you work with, you know, like I'm here in London with Dave Chappelle, or, you know, when I toured with Lenny Kravitz, or working with Quincy Jones or Ben Harper or any of these people, you know, what ends up happening is you forget that it's your life. You know, you kind of forget that I see myself as, you know, the guy who's documenting and photographing everything. But at a certain point, I'm part of that story. And to be able to accept that is really hard for me. It's probably as hard as it was to call myself a photographer, which probably took at least a decade. When people would ask what I do, well, I was a graphic designer. I like to take pictures too. I've never been able to call myself a photographer until maybe like 5 years ago. You know, even when you'd fill in the form, like, what's your job? You know, I would always put the art director thing, because I did that. You know, I still do it, but that was my career, or graphic designer or whatever. But because knowing so many great photographers, being inspired by, you know, the Brassailles, Cartier-Bresson, I mean, even people like Joel Peter Witkin, you know, it's so vast. You know, Man Ray is one of my idols. I'm like, I don't do the same job title that these people do. I'm just like a guy that, you know, worked really hard, get lucky to meet the people he loves and admires and starts working with those people. But I could never be on a, you know, gallery wall. I mean, at that time it was like, you know, it felt real to me. And so, you know, I've talked about the imposter syndrome thing before, but I did have that a lot. And at a certain point, you have to step back and say, fuck it. You know, I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to start telling people I'm a photographer. And people would start introducing me. Oh, this is my friend Matthew. He's a great photographer. I'm like, no. But so this book, I'm glad you saw that, because I actually, you're the first person to kind of mention the vulnerability of it, is specific images that will make me feel like I went back in time and I'm the little boy. You know, I talk about, you know, walking down the Rue Saint-Denis where the prostitutes are and making up stories about my life. And I did that stuff a lot, because at that time, you know, going through, my parents had separated, my mom was, you know, working a lot, my dad was working a lot, they're traveling and stuff. So it was kind of, the Paris streets became my parents and became my best friends. Now, I'm not like Vanilla Ice, where I'm going to say I was homeless when I was a kid, and I was actually not. But my point is, it's not like the streets raised me like a gangbanger, you know what I mean? But it's literally the streets of Paris kept me inspired enough that I never turned into anything negative, or never went to drugs or alcohol. You know, I only got inspiration from it. So to be able to do this book with Tenoyes, who was one of my favorite publishers, they've now been bought out by Gestalten, who's another amazing publisher. You know, to be able to do that, to be able to do a big, heavy book and foil on the cover, they really did everything that I asked for, 240 pages. And I'm just grateful that somebody saw what I saw, you know, and that it's something that I wanted to share, because yes, everybody always wants do celebrity books, you know, do this celebrity, do that celebrity, do blah, 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 or, you know, but for me, that's not, at that moment in time, was not what felt like my expression, you know. I will do, you know, Lenny book, I will do Dave books, whatever. But that, at that moment, I felt like a transition, you know, in my career. And it felt like I need to have this thing that just kind of put on the table and, you know, move to the next thing. But still, like, I just got back from Paris a couple of days ago. I'm still walking around, you know, doing 15, 16, 17 miles a day, literally walking around Paris taking photos. So maybe there'll be a volume two at some point, you know, and I actually would love that because there's so many images that I didn't include. And then now I've shot so many since that I wish I could have included, or I'll do some kind of deluxe edition at some point, you know, where add another 80 pages or something. We'll see.
Oh, it's awesome. I'm glad that I kind of had it kind of right. Cause I think one of the great things about these conversations, and there is a bit like you sort of acknowledging that you're a photographer. I've only been doing this just under 2 years, but I do try and tell people now when they ask what I'm doing, I'm like, well, I'm kind of an artist in the sense that I'm just making something because it should exist.
Yeah.
And I think these conversations are important because there's a job to be done having conversations with contemporary photographers while they work, whilst they talk about where they are right now.
Yeah.
I reference a lot Marc Maron when he talked to a lot of comedians before he went a bit broader with the types of people he'd talk to.
Right.
Because there was a job to be done archiving conversations with comedians as they either reflect on their careers. That's why the conversation with Joel was so important, because it's with his wife, it's with filmmakers. It's not just another conversation with him. And I think that's where your work, similarly, there's plenty of outlets who would publish the celebrity work. There's no shortage.
Yeah.
You know, like,
always contact me.
Yeah, there's no shortage of magazines or books or whatever. So I think this sort of work is vital because that's how we understand the creative person.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that people need to hear about, is that it's everyone feels this way.
Yeah.
You see these people and you assume they've got it all figured out and they know exactly how it's going and they feel just like you.
Yeah.
And they are working it out just like you do.
Absolutely.
So it's crucial. And I loved the red, you know, the introduction you wrote, and then
the red balloon
over the sort of sky.
The one, the only thing I photoshopped in the entire book was making that balloon red.
Sure, but it doesn't. It's earned.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's the thing.
And some people have asked me, or they'll send me a photo of it. Like, what's the deal with that? I'm like, you haven't read the foreword. And there was like one friend that I busted because I was like, did you read the foreword? He's like, of course I read it. And then he's like, why is there a red dot in this photo? I was like, you didn't read the foreword.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I didn't read it. He's like, I scanned through it. I was like, read it, you'll understand.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And there's a couple, what do you call it? What's the term when you hide little things in the book?
Oh, you've like taking stuff out, or like distractions and things? Easter eggs.
I kept thinking rabbit.
Yeah,
there's a couple Easter eggs like that, you know, in the book that only make sense if you read my foreword.
Yeah. Well, and on the subject of the foreword, you mentioned you didn't sort of succumb to vices on the streets, and you didn't, you know, but that's the other thing that stood out to me, was how you've got this kind of, right from the beginning, this kind of get up and go spark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you find out where one of your heroes lives, you go and show up because you want to do this.
Right.
And similarly, like, you know, I think it feels like your family also was always up, like, you know, phoning you up, grandma's died, coming, you arrive, she's fine, it was a ruse.
My dad was quite the, quite the prankster.
So that was a family.
But also, like, that story where I talk about going to the Serge Gainsbourg concert is a great story because, you know, I remember people were like, man, that's really screwed up that your dad would do this. Because, you know, for those who haven't read the foreword, my favorite artist when I was a kid, Serge Gainsbourg, as they call him in English, Serge Gainsbourg, great poet, singer, songwriter, also painter, you know, kind of did it all, provocateur, director, actor. I mean, incredible guy. And he was playing at the casino, the Paris. And so I wanted to go, but it was like on a Thursday night or something. And my dad knew how upset I was. I was in boarding school, so I didn't come home till Friday night on the train. And so he calls the boarding school and says his mother just died. So they come and, you know, grab me and say, we're so sorry, your grandmother, your dad's mom just passed away. And so you're going to have to, you know, leave in the morning and go to Paris. So I'm like mourning the loss of my grandmother. And who was great, Egyptian grandmother, really funny. And I get, you know, I get to Paris in my dad's place, and he's like, here are the tickets to the Serge show. My friend, you know, I was able to get a couple tickets. And I'm like, and when is the funeral? He's like, oh, no, there's no funeral. I just said that to get you out of it. And I was like, man, my dad is a hero. Like, this is amazing. The fact that he would do that.
If you can forgive him for that, then yes, that
would be. Oh, I not even no forgiveness necessary. I thought it was hilarious. And I think I, even when she actually passed away, I remember wondering if it was true or if there was another opportunity. Yeah. But that, you know, that kind of thing. Is exactly there's another really funny story where the movie I guess it was Rocky IV when it came out, and I was a big Rocky fan. I was a huge Stallone fan, and I was in a Waldorf school, a boarding school, and you know Rudolf Steiner and Waldorf school is very anti-media. You make your own. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but sort of like Montessori, similar. And so there's no textbooks. You make the textbooks, which is where I learned so much. I learned how to knit. I learned how to, you know, cut and sew. I mean, all this stuff we were doing. And it's a very child-led education where you focus in on what the student is into and you, you know, nourish that. And for some reason, I'd seen the trailer to the Rocky IV movie. And all I could talk about for the week was, oh man, this weekend I'm going to the movies and I'm going to go see Rocky IV. And I would like be sitting at dinner at the boarding school, and I would put like tomato sauce in my mouth. I'd be like, Rocky IV, and punch my own self and like spit out, you know, spit out fake blood on the girl next to me, you know. And so the teachers were really, or they called them educators, they were very stressed out about me seeing this movie because they felt like it was going to be a very violent influence and all this stuff. And, you know, Dolph Lundgren, I was Draco, you know, I was talking about all this stuff all week. So I finally get home Friday and I'm really excited because this is the weekend, you know, it just came out. And so I get home and the phone rings and it's Henry, my educator, Henry Lichtenberger. And he goes, you know, hey, put your dad on the phone. I need to talk to him. So I put him on the phone. And then, you know, back in the day, you had the little listener on those old rotary phones, you know, where you could listen in on the conversation. So I'm listening on the conversation and the Henry is telling my father, like, listen, you know, we really think this is a very bad idea. He's been talking about seeing this Rocky, very violent boxing movie all week, and he's been acting it out. And you have to think at that time, I think I'm like 12 or something like that, or 13. And so for like 20 minutes, he's just saying, you know, this is just, we're really worried. This is really bad influence. You know, we wish these movies didn't exist. We, you know, it's destroying the culture and blah, 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 blah. And so please make sure that, you know, he does not go. Please support us in this. And at one point, my dad's like, hey, Henry, is there any way I could get your phone number? And he says, yeah, sure. I'm glad you want to talk some more. He's like, because we're going to the 8 p.m. screening of Rocky IV, so I have to call you back tomorrow. And then he hangs up the phone. We go see the movie. I get back on Sunday night. Henry just sees me and he goes, I understand. Come here. And he gives me a big hug. He goes, it's not your fault.
Oh, wow.
He goes, it's your father. The movie was great. I loved it. I probably saw it 5 times, yeah. You know. But that's who my dad is, you know. And so it's hard, like, you know, even this week coming from Paris, hanging out with him and just all that kind of personality being gone is just so devastating, you know. So it's amazing, though, because I took some photos maybe 4 or 5 days ago that I posted of my dad, and somehow, this is the magic of photography, that's him on the photo. That's not the person I was hanging out with, but the smile, he looks fine. He doesn't, you know, I've taken other photos where he really looks like almost like deathly, you know. But those photos somehow, it's like everybody's like, wait, that's not a new photo, right? That's Raymond like 10 years ago. I'm like, no, this is yesterday. So the magic of photography, you know, the magic of the connection between, you know, whether it's your father or a stranger on the street. But I actually was looking at that and feeling like, how did I do that? Because that's not really what was sitting across from me, you know, but somehow, you know, magic, you know, he looks like himself. So I'm grateful for that. And I'm grateful to be able to have a tool that doesn't just, you know, it's not just an iPhone or something, which is great. Like, you can document stuff on your phone. It's fine. But it's not timeless like this, you know. There's nothing like, especially I like to shoot on the monochrome, you know, and there's something about that sense or something about it that it's so timeless, you know, and it automatically looks like Tri-X film or something, you know. So I really am. It's been kind of my. I photographed protests the other day in Paris as well, a few days ago. And I decided to go for the Jim Marshall thing of like one camera, one lens. Because usually I have like 2-3 cameras, you know. I want to have the 21 millimeter, the 75 and the 50 or, you know. But I was like, you know what? Let me just do this whole day with one camera. And then kind of been doing that the whole week and just enjoying, you know, just focusing on that. I'm so addicted to these things, and I'm, you know, always buying more and more lenses. And but I like the vintage stuff, so you know, I'm a bit of a I would say a hoarder of museum quality like a lenses.
Good. So, yeah. I think it's the older glass is important. Yeah. You know, I shoot with a lot of. I picked up a NovaFlex. Last year, and I attached it to my M, and you obviously have to use the Visiflex to be able to see through it, but because the coatings are starting to go on it a little bit as well, so you do get this kind of the best way I can describe it is the photos I get of like the birds and stuff. It's like photos I saw in magazines as a kid.
The flare and everything.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, flare.
No, I really love that, and I've been shooting with the Canon Dream Lens a lot. Mm-hmm. I bought it at the Leica auction, you know, during the 100 years. It's the one thing I bought. The only thing I was like, okay, I'm just going to buy this because it's so dangerous to start bidding on stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting with Jason Momoa, who's buying like 30 things. But, you know, I don't have Aquaman budget, so I was like, I just want that one. And so what I love about these old lenses, like even this one that I just got in Paris, it's a Frankenstein lens. It's black paint on the bottom and black chrome on the top. Apparently they had run out of black paint rings.
Right.
So they made a few. So it's really like a museum piece. And, you know, it's 1970. Look at, I mean, it looks like it was made, you know, it looks new. And that's the thing, you know, why also like I do this is on the old lenses, there was no coating like there is now. So because they spent years developing technology to stop flare and glare and reflections, and I'm like, I love that stuff. So so I have the new ones for when I need to do you know, a job that doesn't have weird flare and all that. And then when I'm, you know, doing stuff for myself or sometimes with artists who do kind of, you know, love the vintage look and everything. I was here a couple months ago shooting Ray, the singer, who I adore and is amazing. And so I use like the 1931 Hector 73 millimeter, and those photos look absolutely incredible. And then I use the old, you know, Noctilux, and it just all look like magical, you know. And so that's, you know, sometimes it's really cool because she has that kind of vintage vibe, you know. So that works really well. And then, you know, we did publicity stuff more with like the SL3S, that's, you know, more modern and everything. But of course, my favorite stuff is all this, you know, monochrome with the old lenses.
No, that's nice. I think it's, they're brushes for us to use. And I think you use them in the, you know, use them the way you want to use them. And I think, because I think if you wanted clinical perfection, and I've noticed this with film, like in the last few years, you know, like in Pretty Thing, or Poor Things, sorry, the use of old vintage glass there just to give it a weird look. And even the guys who are on tour with Oasis at the moment are using those crazy Lomo, the Lomography 85 mil, that just, the background just swirls.
Well, that's why this lens, I actually, it's the first day I haven't had it on my camera in a while because I just got this one, I wanted to test it out, but I've recently gotten this lens. It's one of my favorite lenses ever from Sean, who has the Rancho Mirage store and the San Francisco store, Camera West, who really gets me some of my absolute weirdest and best lenses. And I got this, there's a French company that started in the late 1800s, a cinema company called El Magis. I don't know if you're familiar with them. There was like Kinoptic, Berthiaud. SOM was like the, SOM was the, you know, the Society of Optics and whatever it was, you know, Société d'Optique et something. I'm on very little sleep.
You're doing amazing.
And so they bought out various companies, and Berthiaud was one of them, and El Magis. So this is a 70 millimeter lens that was converted I went to see a couple of experts in Paris about it. They were freaking out over this lens. Thank you, Sean, because it's definitely one of a kind. It's a 70 millimeter. It's probably like a 1.5 f-stop. It doesn't say it on there, but I think we were looking at the openings. Yeah. It looks like it's about that. And in the 70s, somebody took a Canon FD focus ring and put it in the middle. So it kind of served like a VisaFlex, yeah. You know, but, and it's got the original hood. It's all brass, except for this little Canon ring. Huh. I wish I had it on me. Yeah. But the swirl, the bubble, it's literally like, swirly bokeh, you know, if you're just taking like an open, you know, and I'm only shooting it wide open, there's no point in that. And then bubble, so it's like combination of swirl and bubble. You know, usually you're going to get a bubble bokeh or a swirly bokeh. And it's from the guy I saw last week in Paris, the expert, said about 44 of 1945. So it's so incredible. And the fact that like somebody had the, you know, wherewithal to make it an M lens, you know, and the Canon Dream also has that kind of beautiful swirl. I use that for the protest, that and only that. Yeah. And you know, I have a friend, my friend Jason Roman, who's a great photographer. He bought one and he was like, oh, I don't really like shooting wide open all the time. So it's like, for certain people, they don't like that. I'm sure you know Mark DePaola, who's a dear friend of mine. And he's all about wide open, you know, that's his whole look. And so this lens, this other lens I got from Sean, the Kinoptic 75 millimeter, which is also incredible. And that one has like zombie bokeh. I don't know what you want to call it, but it's so strange. But I guess it used to be DePaola's lens and then he traded some stuff. So I'm very happy to have that. But that's what makes me happy is finding odd lenses. You know, I have all the classic Leica lenses pretty much, you know, they have a steel rim from 1960 upstairs that I really want, but I don't really have that budget at the moment after paying my taxes last week. And but you know, that's what's fun too. There's always something I'm looking for and then you find it. And then, you know, I find this Frankenstein thing in Paris and you just, you know, it's just never ending, but that's what makes it fun. And then the second part of that fun is running out in the street and just shooting photos with now something that I know will become part of my photographic legacy in a sense. Yeah. Like, you know, people, I hope someday they're like looking at the work and be like, oh, I can tell he shot this with this lens and I should, you know, and what the hell is this lens? You know, I did a post, Kevin Fickling, do you know Kevin? Yeah. Kevin came over to my place with Gadgen. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was the ESL ambassador, and so he saw that Amagis lens and was like, what the hell is this? You know, and this dude has like, and took some portraits of me and everybody, you know, and was messaging me when I posted it, like, what lens is this? This is crazy. And some people I was like, I tell them what it is, and some other people just to mess with them, I was like, this is a, you know, a prototype like a Noctilux from 1954, you know, and it didn't come out until 1966. I'm just messing with them, and then at some point I let them off the hook, you know. But I'm a big, like my dad, I guess I'm a big jokester too. So, but it is that discovery, you know. Some people don't get it. They're like, "What the hell? How much did you spend on this lens? Are you out of your mind?" You know. But I mean, this is my career, and it's part of what I do, you know. So I don't care about cars. Like I have like a Ford Edge SUV. I really don't care if it's safe and I can transport big enough prints, you know, and it's safe for my family. I don't care about, you know, I've got one nice watch. That's all I need. Like, but cameras, lenses, that's just, I mean, that's my thing, you know, but it seems to be working out as far as the work goes. And people, you know, are always excited to see these cameras. I had stopped on the street like three times yesterday, walking around London. Yeah. One was a young photographer, his name was Luke, and he, you know, starting out, and he saw the Leica and you know, was talking about M11, blah, blah, blah. And another guy was asking me just, what is this? It's so beautiful. And then I went to a hotel to meet Dave. And as I was walking out, somebody, you know, same thing. Mm. What is this? This is incredible. And you know, and Leica knows also how many cameras I've sold for them that way, by telling people this is what this is, or what did you take this picture with, this camera, this lens. And, you know, I'm around a lot of people, you know, with who have the budgets for these things. Sure. And they're always like, oh, I just went and bought, you know, what the hell? I just spent $60,000 on two lenses and one camera. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, now have fun, you know. And then some people who thought it was easy, you know, will be like, this camera sucks. It's all blurry. And, yeah, you know, I can't find the autofocus on this M camera. And I'm like, I forgot to tell you something.
Yeah, we need to have chat.
Before you spend that 60 grand, I forgot to tell you there is no autofocus. And, yeah, you know, but then this challenge, you know, some people is a challenge accepted. I'll go out and learn how to use it. And that's a lot of fun. You know, I think my son Miles, who's a photographer, great photographer, is started on the MP.
Right.
You know, that's what he knows. Yeah. You know, he was like 12 or 13 assisting me. Mm. And my dear friend Kieran Carnani, I'm sure you know Kieran, who used to be, you know, head of marketing at Leica, she, you know, had sent him a loaner or whatever, and he started working with me, and he started doing his own thing. Then he went off to college, and now he's like a legit great photographer. He's never shot on anything but Leica, which is, I'm so jealous of that. Like, I wish I had that story, you know. And so it's awesome to have a body of work that just started on Leica. That I feel like that must be amazing. And but he's such a hard worker, and you know, people say, oh, why do you hire a son? That's nepotism. But he's so good.
Yeah.
And he's my son. I like to hang out with him, and he's very reliable, and I don't have to worry about somebody I don't know sending certain photos to people, you know, if it's especially if it's celebrity things. Yeah. And trust is such an important part of my work. You know, I've had so many experiences where I know I'm there because I'm the guy they know will not screw them over. And trust me when I tell you, these weird, you know, yellow journalism paper have contacted me many times. We heard you were there. We'll give you this much money for a photo. Okay, that's not enough. We'll double it. Oh, you know, somewhere we're like some celebrities with a different woman, or and they know I was there, and they saw the woman walked out 5 seconds before him, and then he walked out, and you know, well, Matthew was in there, he must have a photo of them. Yeah, we'll give you $100,000 for, you know. I'm like, damn, I want that $100,000, but I also don't want to be that guy. That's never been me, you know. So I think now they know. They don't really contact me anymore because I've turned these things down so many times, whether it's even sometimes it's like Entertainment Tonight or People Magazine, and you know, TMZ, of course, you know, but I like being, you know, the trustworthy photographer. My career has gotten me this far. And I think that's something that people need to learn. And young photographers also need to learn how to like lay off of people, you know, because last night, you know, with an example, like Madonna was at our show last night, you know, and she's was sitting in the dressing room, and she's talking to Dave and blah, blah, blah. And my friend Guy Osiri, who's her manager, is like, oh, that's the shot, you know. And I missed a shot because I'm not going to assume without asking that I can just jump in and take photos of Madonna, you know. Dave, obviously, I'm with him, so he knows if I'm shooting, there's a reason. But, and then, you know, I said to Guy, oh, is it okay? And he's like, of course, man, it's you, like, whatever. Yeah. But I'm never going to assume that it's okay to just shoot. I don't like that. I need to ask permission, you know. I'm not a paparazzi. So, you know, I missed a cool shot last night, but whatever. I got some other ones, and there's always more. But I think that's very important. It's something that's lost on a lot of young photographers that I see. Even when I was, you know, when I'm photographing concerts, sometimes I'll do, rarely, but, you know, if it's like the Rolling Stones or something, I'll do the first three songs, which I'm so spoiled. I'm not used to being the guy that only gets to shoot the first three songs. Mm-hmm. But hey, Rolling Stones, I'll do one song, you know, I'm happy to shoot it. And it's so distracting. I've talked about this before, but I'm sitting here, there's always at least one M, but they're, you know, it's something like that where they're so far, it's not really going to do anything. Mm-hmm. So I'm still shooting, even if I'm shooting with the SLs on a 90 to 280 or like a 600 Sigma or something, I'm still not putting it in, you know, multi-mode or whatever. I like to get the shot and focus in on the shot and get the, but in my ear is like somebody who has their finger down on the shutter.
Yeah.
And it's like, brrr, you know, like a machine gun. And it's so distracting to me that I'm like, and so I've asked guys, like, how many photos? I'm just curious because you're only doing three songs. And this kid told me about 7,000. Nice. Like for three songs. That means like in like a 9 minute, let's say 10, yeah. 10, 11 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
You have to edit 7,000 photos. All right. I was upset I got like, you know, 700 or whatever, you know.
Sure.
Or yeah, not even for that, you know. But yeah, you get nervous, like you got to get the shot.
Yes.
But in my case, it's not usually for a magazine or something. So if I, you know, it's not necessarily to get the shot for a post or something. It's just to know I get stuff that I'll be happy I have, you know, or if they want to use it, they can use it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I would go crazy because I'm already up, you know, coming back at 5, 6 a.m. from sure. the club and I want to edit photos. If I had 7,000 photos to edit, right. I might just jump out the window.
But it also shows, it speaks to a lack of opinionatedness. Mm. And I think this is, again, this is why, you know, I'll big my own stuff up, but this is why I think these conversations are so important, because it's before you push the shutter, before you go and get a camera that can shoot, you know, 120 still frames a second or, you know, whatever, and all that technology exists, that's fine.
Yeah.
What did you want to make? And fair enough if that changes when you're there and you're in the moment and opportunities present themselves, and that's fine. But what did you actually want to make? Because if all you wanted to do was sort of capture what was exactly in front of you, like, I don't believe that you're capturing, that you're actually in the moment.
Right.
I believe you're worried about that, and I think that comes across in the images.
Yeah.
I think the thing that works with yours, it's not like you stood in that alleyway with Dave no. in the snow and took 100 no. images until you had the snow yeah. just right.
Like, and you know, and I accept, like, you know, even last night's a good example, because again, because it was Madonna, I didn't want to shoot even 20 frames, so I just took like 4.
Yeah.
You know, and then I was looking at the photos, I was like, oh damn, she's not looking at me in all 4. She was kind of looking off.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was like, you know what? I'll darken the sunglasses, you can't see that. And that's it, it's the same yeah, photo, yeah. but it saves the photo because suddenly you're not like, wait, where's she looking, you know?
Yeah.
But I would rather that than like her being in her mind like, oh my God, when is this guy gonna stop flashing me, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's one thing, you know, that I can say. Sometimes I will, like last night was definitely one of those nights where I was like, oh man, I should have shot a few more. Sure. But in my mind, I was like, instinct, you know, you got to follow your instinct.
Well, you've also got to think about the future. You're going to run into these people again.
Yeah, yeah, so, it's definitely not the first time, it's not the last time.
Exactly. So if you're, you know, you don't want her walking, or anyone you've encountered walking into the room again going, oh, that guy took a lot last night.
Right, like, right. Like last night, you know, we're at the Children Firehouse, and yeah. which is temporarily just open for Fashion Week because it's half burned down. They're going to be remodeling it for 2 years. But and it was like not the crowd that used to be at the Firehouse yeah. because it's like a promoter that blah, blah, blah. And I was like, man, like to be someone like Dave is so cool and so nice with everybody. But sometimes, man, I'm sure he wants to have an invisibility
oh, yeah.
cloak, you know,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
where he's just like, can I just chill and not have every person walk up to me for a selfie or this or that. And so that's, you know, but as they say, it's the price of fame, so to speak. But at the same time, respect
yes.
is more important than that. And, you know, yeah. so often I'm talking to people like, just don't, like, just please, like, yeah. let him yeah. be, you know. Yeah. I went through this with Lenny Kravitz for so many years. Like, let the guy just have dinner. Like, you're coming up to him as he's putting a bite of food in his mouth, asking him for a selfie. Or,
yeah.
oh, my girlfriend's on the phone, she's a big fan. Or my mom's on the phone, you know. You know, and it's...
Yeah,
it's not cool, you know. So yeah, I'm always respectful, you know. I mean, even last night at that children party, there's a bunch of people, I didn't take a single photo. I just followed my instinct. I was yeah. I had the camera, but I was like, yeah, you know what, if I start doing it, people are going to start asking for photos.
Yes.
They're going to start bugging him like, oh wait, will you take one with me, because it's yeah. you know, our phones are locked up or whatever, but
yeah.
will you take one. So I opted to just not take any yeah. photos last night. And when people could say, hey, will you take a photo of me? No, I'm not shooting tonight. Or sometimes I'll be like, oh, they don't allow photos in here, which generally at the children yes. was the thing. They didn't tell me that last night, but you know, it's just a matter of respect. Like respect yeah. to me, it's a combination of respect and gratitude. You know, I think that's the E equals MC squared of my,
yeah.
of
yeah.
my career, you know, and communication
yes.
is very important. I just had a situation that I was not too happy about with one of those things where like I shot something and then the thing came out and it wasn't the photo that I shot.
Right.
It was like somebody was on the set and took like a BTS photo, and then they're being, oh, that's cool, that looks like lo-fi, like iPhone quality, and they use that as the cover. That was pretty upsetting, you know. And so now I'm like, okay, noted, no more BTS. You can do your video thing, but no more BTS photographers on my shoots, you know. I hate to be that guy, but at a certain point, you know, you learn.
Yes.
And I'm 52, it took me that long. I mean, I usually don't have it, especially if it's, you know, anything that's like Dave or whatever, there would not be anyone else. But in this case, you know, it's kind of upsetting.
Yeah.
And and the fact that, you know, and it's fine, I've talked to these people about it, but the fact that nobody told me that that happened and I had to see it come out, you know, if you get excited about something and you see it out and you're like, wait, that's not my picture, and it looks like somebody just did that, you know.
Sarah Lee talked about something similar with me recently. You're in a position of power as well as a photographer.
Yeah.
And you, if you're making images of people, because the person you're photographing, you might not even like very much.
Right.
Or you might have not met them before, and you might come to not like them very much. Like, who knows? But you're in a position of power, irrespective of how you feel about them. Like, she photographs a lot of politicians and things, and she, you know, might be throwing her slipper at the TV if they're on TV. But in that moment, there's a job to do, and the job is to capture them in a way, and you can choose how they look. You can choose whether they look, you know, a bit like when we're photographing family or...
Yeah, I love Sarah. She's great.
She's
great
pretty
photographer.
Cool.
Yeah, and super cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that goes back to what I said in the beginning of like, would I photograph Trump or Mussolini? Yeah, I would, you know, it doesn't mean I like them. But what is cool is you can light them in a way that subtly you don't like them, and you can see that you don't like them.
Yes.
And
yeah.
That would be a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
But I feel like Trump, every time he gets photographed, looks evil when he gets professionally photographed.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of the photographers are doing it on purpose, you know, the overhead light, the kind of...
Well, it's the big strong man thing, isn't it? He likes it. He likes to look like the big strong dude. And
no, he wants to be a dictator, so, you know, he likes to look like one, so...
Yeah, he's making the right decision.
I think this Project 2025 thing that they kept saying was not real is like 70% already.
Yeah.
They're at 70% of, you know... what they said they were going to do, and it's only been 9 months.
I know, they told us, like, there's a playbook they're following, like they weren't shy about it. No, it's,
and he said, no, it's not real, blah blah blah, and then the second he's in, you know.
No,
really crazy.
I was talking to him, talking to Bill last week about that stuff, Bill Brown, and so your episodes will be back to back.
Shout out Bill Brown. Quite,
he's all right, let's not get carried away. No, we had a lovely chat, it was really good.
He's a beatnik.
Exactly. Where he got his first Leica, because
Allen Ginsberg.
M6.
Yeah.
When you do shoot film, are you an M6 person, M7, or
M6, MP, M7?
Right.
And I just got this beautiful camera. It was a gift from Dave, actually, at Vienna Classic. It's the Platinum M6 with the snakeskin. I don't know if you've ever seen that. It was 1989, 75 year of Leica, 150 years of photography.
Yeah.
Number 007 is just the number of out of 125. So that was pretty cool. Dave gifted me that as a belated birthday present when we were in Vienna. So I'm very excited about shooting a lot of that monopan film on that camera.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, we'll get our hands on that.
Well,
I mean, thank you so much for doing this. This is amazing.
My pleasure, man.
I've loved it. When can we expect the next book and the next big project from you?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not there yet. I have been shooting a whole other type of thing that I'm thinking could be a little more arty. You know, it's nature stuff. So I was wondering if it'll actually happen, but I've been doing a lot of weird macro photography of waterfalls and things in Ohio when I'm out there with Dave and in the forests, and so, but I really like the way this stuff is looking, you know, it's like almost like a MC Escher kind of weird stuff, so we'll see. I think probably doing a Dave book would be the next big thing, you know, because that would be amazing, and people would look at it and wonder if it was AI, because there'll be so many crazy moments, you know, from whether it's in Europe or Africa, or, you know, the people that we photograph together. So that might be a really fun project, you know, to work on. I've started kind of outlining stuff and, you know, having documented all the Netflix specials and the, you know, tours and at home and behind, you know, it would be really cool. So we'll see. I wouldn't mind that being, you know,
that's really cool.
But Paris Blues is still very alive for me. You know, it's only had LA and New York exhibitions, so
right.
I'm hoping to get into some other cities. And I'm doing a book signing in DC. I don't know when this come out, but it'll probably be on October 9th. I'm doing a book signing at the Washington DC Leica store. So Dave's got a big show on the 10th at the arena. So it's kind of bookended.
And it will come out beforehand, so we can send folks
perfect
your
perfect
way. So yeah,
cool. Well, I really appreciate you coming down and
pleasure.
I like the format of this a lot, where it's like I'm not having to really think about what it's just conversation.
Yeah,
you know, I really like the way you do this stuff.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it's a gift to be able to do it. Like that's the thing, is it's a privilege, and what's lovely is sitting down with folks like this and just having a nice long form conversation and just letting it go where it goes. Like, you know, you scribble notes or whatever, but you let it go where it goes. And then, you know, cause in the aim is there'll be other conversations, and then you've got a body of work then where you can refer back to similar conversations or related photographers, and as the network starts to emerge. So that's awesome. What I hope we're doing, but thanks so much, man.
Man, thanks so much. I really appreciate you coming down. We actually did it.
We did.
And there's no video, which is great.
How about that, huh? That's a good one, wasn't it? That was definitely worth a flight down to London. Really, really good to talk to Matthew. Thank you so much for being on the show, my friend. I hope our paths cross again. And I'd also like to say a massive thank you to the folks at Leica in London. So that's David and Sam and Arta in particular, who were just really helpful. We descended upon them unannounced and they just found a space for us, let us sit there for an hour or so, brought us some lovely coffee and water and things to nibble on while we chatted. They were very, very kind and very gracious. So thank you guys. I really, really appreciate your help. And you are now part of Prime Lenses history. If you enjoyed that, don't forget that you can like and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. So that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, all those places. Please do subscribe. If you feel so inclined, hit us up with a review, tell a friend. And don't forget that you can also sign up to the newsletter. There's a link to that in the show notes. It's on primelensespodcast.com/sign-up. And finally, there is a Patreon, so that helps to fund trips to London to record things like this and travel around the place. So if you would like to support the show that way and you can, then that would be really appreciated as well. Have a fantastic week. Let's do this again next week. That was fun. Have a good one, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.